Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
This variant is insubordinate, stubborn, unpredictable.
You need the God of Mischief.
Unbelievable! Wherever you go, it's just death, destruction, the literal ends of worlds.
Okay. Change. Change. Maybe Loki wants to mix it up. Is that possible? Can change.
I am Loki, and I am burdened with glorious purpose.
Change.
Hello, and welcome to episode 6 of Still Watching Loki, but not our last episode of Still Watching Loki. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson, and joining me is...
I am Vanity Fair correspondent Anthony Bresnikan.
Oh, Anthony Bresnikan is here. So we are switching up the order of the podcast. We're doing things a little differently here in our last sort of full episode of the podcast. We've got some fun friends joining this week. Richard is once again off in gay Paris. He's in Cannes. He's not in Paris. Anyway, he's in France. We've got the great Alan Sepinwall from Rolling Stone magazine. Fantastic TV writer here to talk to me. I think I'm going to make him talk to me about like Loki as a TV series, more so than though he's a nerdy comic book guy. He can get nerdy.
So you don't have the Richard, but you have a Richard.
It's true. We also have Richard E. Grant, classic Loki himself. And we're going to leave that towards the end of the episode because it's one of those interviews that's like a little silly that it's on this episode because obviously he's not in the finale. We didn't talk about the finale at all. I hadn't seen it. But folks, am I going to pass up a chance to talk to Richard E. Grant? I am
Who
not.
Would? Who
are
would?
Are you going to pass up a chance to listen to him? You are not. So it's just going to be like a fun little treat for you at the end of the episode. And then we've got a couple great interviews for our wrap-up episode that we're going to do after this. So we're going to take a little time. I'm going to get a little sleep. You guys are going to send us your emails, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com, and we're going to answer all your questions, talk to some fine folks who worked on the show, and wrap it all up in one more episode after this. So this is the penultimate Still Watching Loki episode. Anthony Bresnikan, before we get started on anything, we've got some emails. I have some thoughts.
Okay, but Joe, but wait. Stop.
Yeah.
Before we get to that, I have to shout you out a little bit for the listeners here, because I know listeners are also readers. Joanna is walking wounded right now on the podcast. She has been up for easily more than 24 hours. She stayed up and watched Loki at midnight. She did this amazing write-up. I would suggest I binged it. I tore through it right before we did this chat because I'm not feeling 100%. I've got a little bit of sniffles. So I crashed early, but I woke up early, and Joe had already created this amazing document full of awesome GIFs and insights. So go read that, pause us, and then come back. You did an amazing job, Joanna, and I feel like you've been manning the time desk or whatever it is that that we see at the end, whatever you want to call that office with all the windows. You've been there forever, and I feel like I just walked through one of the portals, but I'm really happy to be here talking about it with you.
That's so funny. I was thinking maybe that together you and I could rule the TVA. So that's the analogy I was going to go for. But thank you so much. That was really, really sweet.
We're all villains here, yeah. Joanna.
so if I sound delirious, it's because I am. No, I think this is going to be a fun episode. So I wanted to start by asking you, I mean, since you've read that piece that I wrote that's up on BF.com right now, you know how I feel about the episode, but I want to know how you feel. Are you up on it? Did it leave you cold? How are you feeling?
I loved it. I also felt like victory, glorious purpose, because you and I, many of our predictions came true on this one. And I can't say that was accurate on WandaVision.
I mean, I definitely had plenty wrong thoughts and feelings about Loki, but I wasn't mad about it at all because I loved the episode. But I think you were the one who was like, I definitely think it's Kang. And I was like, I don't think they're going to do Kang the whole episode. I think an end of credits. And then the episode started. I was like, oh, it's the Kang show. Okay, here we go.
And Miss Minutes proved to be the spy villain that we believed she was.
A little shady Miss Minutes. Yeah, so we're going to talk about all of that. But I kind of want to do this a little bit in a specific order. So we're going to get to Kang is what I'm calling that character, even though he was never referred to as such in the show. He's called He Who Remains,
which is creepy. And I love that he goes, ooh, isn't that creepy? Like, I love that, how self-aware this Kang is.
But he, you know, this is a version of Kang the Conqueror, a character we've talked about a lot on this podcast, played by the wonderful Jonathan Majors. And we are going to talk about that a lot for sure. But I wanted to actually just start and get out of the way the other part of the episode, which is a very little bit of screen time, which is what Mobius and Ravonna and B-15 are up to in this episode, which I think is sort of like the weakest. It feels like they just really undernourished that in order to just feed this other part. And I'm not mad because I love the episode, but like, if you know, if you're asking me like, and how did they wrap up everything for Mobius and Ravonna? And I'm like, they just sort of kind of did it. So, I mean, what do you think about all of that TVA stuff?
They did not. I mean, I think they aggressively didn't wrap it up. It was like we got a little bit of, you know, like we found out what the pen meant, I guess. You know, but good eye on you. As soon as they showed that in the previously on, I was like, ah, Joanna knew about the pen, and previously on is tipping its hat to us. Undernourished, I think, is a good way of describing it, but not unsatisfying. To me, it felt more like, especially given the fact that at the very end of the episode, we get the official stamp that there will be a Loki season 2. I think if I didn't know that, I would be like, yeah, where are they going with this Ravonna Mobius stuff? But I think clearly they were leaving that, you know, sometimes you tell a story and you deliberately leave tracks of narrative in order for it to be explored in the next story. And I think that's still something that I felt like I got enough resolution that I was okay. I'm okay holding off for a year or two till we get Loki season 2.
Yeah, we don't have like a ton of information about the when and why for of that, but there was, you know, the earliest report that there was going to be a season 2 was, that I can find, is on Comic Book Resources in November of last year. This had been sort of soft announced, right? Like Michael Waldron signed an overall deal with Disney, and part of that whole thing was that they wanted him for Loki season 2. And so November 20th, something like that, or November 2020, I suppose, is when the CBR article goes up. And in that CBR article, there's a link to like Production Weekly or something where they talked about January 2022 as a start of production on Loki. Mm. So that would be like a good long while. But I mean, they've got a lot of stuff lined up that they're working on in between. And the other thing I want to say about that is like, we know, for example, that Jonathan Majors is going to be in Ant-Man and the Wasp Quantumania. There's also just some other ripples that we can definitely talk about that seem like they're going to touch other shows and other films that are upcoming. So it's not like we're going to press pause on this disaster and then pick it up exactly in season two, because it's going to ripple out onto other properties in the MCU. So, but I hear what you're saying. Like, it doesn't bother me at all that, you know, Ravonna leaving feels very much like a cliffhanger, because this is a season, not series finale of an ongoing story. So, you know, tune in next time to find out what Ravonna is up to. But to me, like, correct me if I'm wrong, but so like Miss Minutes comes and she brings Ravonna some files and she says, he thinks these would be useful for you. And Ravonna reads them and she decides to go off in pursuit of something. And to me, it feels very like Biff Tannen getting the sports almanac in Back to the Future 2, and going, she's going somewhere in time to find a Kang and ally herself with him to get a taste of some free will, which puts her on track for her comic book role, which is like a Kang consort and like, you know, partner in crime. So is that your read on what we saw?
Yeah, that was a trail of breadcrumbs sent to be scattered by Miss Minutes and lead her to a certain destination, I guess, or a certain point in time. It's funny, she's in pursuit of free will, but she's just completely following the, she's been hooked like a fish, you know, and is being reeled in. So not exactly free will when you're getting pulled in like that. She, you know, you did a lot in your write-up that I just mentioned that I thought was wonderful, like comparing this to Lost, and drew some comparisons. Some I noticed, some I didn't, so I was really impressed with that. And then there's a Doctor Who shout-out in there, too. And the character from pop culture that this version of Ravonna reminds me of is Nadine from Stephen King's The Stand.
Oh, okay. Hit me.
Have you read that book? Or
I have, but it's been a little while, so please refresh
me. So if you remember her, she was the one who, like, she's in the camp of the good people, like the folks who are following Mother Abigail, who have sort of, like, pure intentions. They're not perfect, but then, like, the people who are sort of selfish and cruel, like, they end up going to the path of, they go to Las Vegas to find, this dark figure, the walking dude, the Randall Flagg, and he wants her as his. As the word you used was consort, right? Like, he wants her to be his, the mother of his spawn. He's demonic, so he can't really say he's going to have a child, but he wants to reproduce, and his heir is going to be. She's going to be the mother. She's going to be like the dark version of a Virgin Mary type figure, you know.
Mm-hmm.
From Catholicism, and you know, the tragic thing about her character is that she doesn't want this. She doesn't really want it. She wants to be free, right? And yet she feels this pull toward this destiny, and that's what Ravonna reminded me of, is that she's saying all the right things, right? Like, we deserve to be free, I want to know who's really running things, I want to be independent, but she is completely taking the bait every time. And I think, you know, when I say there's a comparison, I think it's not that I feel Waldron is, you know, is poaching from The Stand. I think it's instead writers who have good insight into human nature. Often, you know, there are these sort of repeated patterns in storytelling because human beings are that way. It's not that you have any special foresight when something happens that's familiar to us through a TV show or a book. It's that the writers know human nature, and they know in certain types of situations how people behave. And I think that's what we have here, is she's the person who outwardly projects a lot of confidence, but inwardly she's she's gravitating toward, she's moving toward that thing that's pulling her, you know? She's not resisting.
Yeah, and I wish we had gotten a little bit more of her, you know, teacher persona, like who she was before the TVA. Because, you know, if she was sort of, she seems a little, like, meeker and a little, you know, she's wearing, like, a lovely little flower dress and stuff like that. It stands in stark contrast to sort of the authoritarian version of her in the TVA. So, mm-hmm. like, yeah, she's found her glorious purpose.
Yeah.
She's found a path to walk. And I think it's interesting. It just, as we both agree, feels a little underfed in general.
Nadine was also a teacher in The Stand, by the way. It's another parallel.
Oh, so, nice. Yeah. There's not much more I want to say about that. I mean, like, we didn't get Mobius on a jet ski, but maybe we'll get that in season two. We still don't know who Mobius was before all this. I'm not clinging to my Loki theory at all. I'm just saying we don't know who he is. So, you know, that's a tune in for season two to find out Mobius' backstory if we get it. You know, sort of thing.
Interesting thing to leave behind. Tune in for season two to see how the jet ski pays off. But also tune into season two to see how the rings on the table pay off.
Yeah.
do the rings mean something, or was that just merely a reminder in that moment of him for her?
I think so, but also I think what they're trying to establish here is that, like, Ravonna has this, like, glorious mm-hmm. purpose, this path that she's decided she's going to go on, but she is still vulnerable to some influence from Mobius, right? She doesn't prune him. So, like, I feel like if we follow her story down the line, there's the possibility that if things get out of control, like, only Mobius will be able to stop her, sort of thing.
Yeah. What do you think she's actually drawn to? She says power. I'm trying to find the, I think it's power, too.
Power, yeah.
Like, which... we use the word consort, but actually it's queen, right?
She's... Yeah, yeah. I regretted saying consort as soon as I said it, so I'm glad you corrected it.
But consort isn't anything sleazy. It's just, you know, you're like a... Like a gangster's mall, or
I want to give her something a little bit more lofty than that. I agree. So yeah,
she's not a concubine or something like that.
No, that's not what I meant. But there is a possibility that even though we do see Jonathan Major's face on the giant statue at the end, like maybe the power behind the throne in all of that, we'll get to that. But maybe it's actually Ravonna. Like maybe she goes and finds a king variant that she can manipulate, and maybe she's actually the one in charge. We don't know. We'll find out.
I think she's being positioned as a bad guy, and there'll be some effort to redeem her, but I think she is going to go, what is the phrase that Jonathan Majors uses? Like, we've crossed the threshold? Like,
yeah. Oh, my God.
I think there'll be a moment where she crosses a threshold and really can't come back. You know, she'll go into Lady Macbeth territory.
I was gonna say dark Sansa in my Game of Thrones parlance. Yeah, no. We'll see what happens to her. I want to move over to the Kang stuff. Mm-hmm. And I want to start with this email we got before the finale from Glenn, and it was real. I was really glad that I read this before the finale because it helped me grasp the finale better. Glenn starts his email: "Hello, classic Joanna, Crocodile Anthony, and poor pruned Richard." he said, "There's been a lot of talk about Kang over the course of the show, but I thought it was interesting that you haven't mentioned one of his key elements of this character, his multiple incarnations that show up and occasionally work at cross purposes to each other. A very brief history of Kang. Spoilers. Comic book spoilers. He is born Nathaniel Richards in a far future utopia and is possibly a descendant of Mr. Fantastic Reed Richards, his father, also named Nathaniel Richards, who is also a time traveler, and or Dr. Doom, who is also a time traveler. Future Nathaniel Richard, bored in paradise, decides to conquer not only his current era, but the past and future via Dr. Doom's rediscovered time machine. He is the ancient Egyptian pharaoh Ramatut, who is defeated by the Fantastic Four, the Scarlet Centurion, who used psychological and technological manipulation to stop the rise of superhumans, and Kang the Conqueror, who is a classic enemy of the Avengers. Importantly, two of his incarnations, his first and his last, stand in contrast to his traditional MO of being a temporal warlord, Iron Lad, and Immortus." And so he goes on to talk about how Iron Lad, who we've talked about a little bit about in context of Young Avengers, and Immortus are sort of... defending against the negative influence of these more warlike conqueror characters. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of what we see here is, like, I'm not saying the He Who Remains is a good guy. He calls himself a villain, right? But he's positioning himself as the lesser devil of your options of devils here. So, mm-hmm. I mean, like, what do you think of this idea of we get to meet this one? We're just going to call him Kang because it's easier, and that's just what we're going to do. We meet this Kang, played by Jonathan Majors, and we get this threat of all these other Kangs. How does all of this work for you?
Yeah, I mean, yes, Glenn, you're right. But we did mention that Kang is a Nexus being, and in the comics, that means in all the various timelines, sometimes you exist, sometimes you don't, but Nexus beings are like, they're a vein that runs through all the timelines. So there's a Kang, and there's a Kang for every time. And so we did mention that.
Well, I thought when we talked about Nexus beings, though, that we talked about how they're all the same across all the timelines.
Yeah, I think he's not that different. I mean, he mentions their variations and all that, and some are meaner than others, but
I think they all look like Jonathan Majors, at least the little like putty versions of them on the deck.
That's what I mean. Is they like weren't Majors. They weren't as varied as Loki's. You know,
no Gator Kang. As far as Gator Kang.
Yeah. So and even he was like, oh, we would meet each other and be like, nice nose, right? Like, yeah, so your face is the same.
Yes. Yes.
So I think it's like, you know, they at least somewhat closely align. And I also think that bears out. Like he's a dastardly character. And I also just loved Jonathan Majors' performance. We talked about our eagerness to see him on the show or to see his version of Kang. And if you remember, like, I was like, he's interesting casting for a villain because he's so charming, like, he's so magnetic. I really, every time I see him on screen, it's not that he plays the same character, but he has a kind of it has charisma. It's almost not big enough a word. I just love watching him. And what I really enjoyed about this performance is he dialed up the mania. Like, he was a manic character. And rather than, like, some sort of, like, stoic, scary, you know, ominous character, which I was, whenever you see somebody rendered in sculpture, and I do think they put some characteristics of him in that central timekeeper image. But you know, whenever you see somebody rendered in a sculpture, they're always a little more ominous than they are in real life. But I love that he was like munching an apple again. Oh, yeah. Talk about like, you know, Judeo-Christian, scripture, like, you know, the apple thing just felt very Garden of Eden to me too. I don't know if you
That at all. Yep. Yeah. I have that in my notes. Apple, snake, garden, all of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, because we get the temptation, right, first for Loki and Sylvie when they walk in. We get Miss Minutes come up and she offers them, you know, you get to have only happy memories of your childhood, Sylvie, and you, Loki, will have gotten to, you could defeat Thanos. And there's one really touching part of that brief little exchange, which is that when she's talking about that, you can have the Infinity Gauntlet, you can have the throne. But what's playing on the score is that Ragnarok theme.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what he's thinking about is like, I can save Asgard if I do this. Not right. Like glorious power, but like I can save my homeland that's destroyed.
But the apple thing I think is like, if I'm Michael Waldron, I'm cheering because whenever you write something creatively and you build little illusions in, and nobody picks them up because they just glean across the surface. Like, I think this is what happens when Adam and Eve don't take the temptation. When they reject the temptation, the devil says, well, then I'll eat the apple, right?
I think that's what he led them to.
And
we should say that this episode is written by Michael Waldron and Eric Martin.
Oh, yes.
And that something Waldron told me in the initial interview that I did with him is that, you know, he got plucked out of the writer's room to go do Doctor Strange. And so I asked him, I was like, well, if something needs to be changed in the script, who's writing it if you're working on Doctor Strange? And he said, Eric Martin. So collaboratively, like, but Eric Martin was the guy there sort of working on stuff. And something that Kate Herron told me very interestingly is that they did a lot of work over the pandemic pause to change and tighten scripts. And now I'm going to say something and I'm going to preface it. If you're listening to this podcast right now and you're someone who likes to post on Reddit, welcome. I'm so glad you're here. I love that you listen to this podcast. But sometimes what happens is if I say something, it gets popped up on Reddit as Vanity Fair's Joanna Robinson Report. So I'm just going to preface what I'm about to say with, this is not Joanna Robinson from Vanity Fair Reports. However, you write that, I can't control it. That's whatever. But I'm just saying this for the record. That is not what this is. But I will say, I've heard through some back channels, so this is not a reported concrete thing. This is a nebulous rumor. Are your journalistic instincts like freaking out right now, Anthony?
Yeah, stuff. All my circuits are shorting out. I'm like,
I have heard that Kang pre-pandemic, that Kang was actually going to be a post-credits appearance.
Hmm.
And that they changed it, maybe partially. I don't know the reason why. It could be because they decided they wanted a season two of the show, which they seem to have decided maybe around November. Or it could be that they saw what Jonathan Majors could do and they were like, oh, we want more of this, please. But if you think about, I mean, that is a wild rewrite. If that is true, if Kang was just supposed to be a post-credits, then I was trying to imagine like what the episode is without Kang in it. And I think it's a longer temptation sequence with Ms. Minutes, because there is a sequence from the trailers where you see Loki on the throne of Asgard clad in gold, and we never see it in the show. And they put it even in the most recent trailer. So like it was footage they definitely shot that. And so I'm thinking like Ms. Minutes would have shown them what their life was, you know, like just an extended seduction of Christ sort of thing. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Or temptation of Christ. That's just pure conjecture. But like the idea that they rewrote it so that instead of appearing at the end of credits, Jonathan Majors is going to pop in and monologue exposition for almost the entire episode. I almost can't believe it, but my source is pretty good. So I'm just thinking about it. But like this episode, for what it's worth, does not work at all if Jonathan Majors isn't as extraordinary as he is in this role, right? Can you imagine if they had cast a lesser actor? Marvel is really good casting track record, but let's say they cast kind of a dud and we have to just sit and listen to him explain things to us for an hour in the Loki finale. Like, imagine that reality, Anthony Bresnikan.
You know what's funny is about the thing I will say thematically that fits into the storyline with his performance is that he's there's a bit of a meta thing going on here, right? At one point, the character lays down the script for the episode we're watching. You know, I mean, it's technically like a transcript of just what's going to happen, but really it's the script, right? Like it's what we're seeing. And he's like, I know what's coming. And what I think is extraordinary about Jonathan's performance is that even though he's reading lines and delivering a performance that was written, it feels out of control to me, right? Mm-hmm. It feels very much like a live wire, and how are we going to get this, how are we going to pin this down, right? Without electrocuting ourselves, or, you know, how do you capture this thing? Like, this guy
is... Yeah. And I think it's because all of his choices are so surprising. Like, I've rewatched the episode, you know, all the way through twice and, like, bits here and there a couple times over this course of this sleepless night. Yeah. And just every line reading, I'm like, this is such a surprising take. And is like, and what he does physically, like, hopping up on the desk, or the way he gestures, or, like, all this sort of stuff, it's just wild and fascinating. And for me, and it reminds me a bit about of Owen Wilson as Mobius, because Owen Wilson also has just, like, very surprising delivery of lines. That's his trademark. Is you don't really know how he's going to deliver a line, and it's going to be fun.
Do you know who it reminded me of?
Yeah,
who? One of the all-time greatest performance in movie history is Denzel Washington in Training Day.
Ooh,
and if you think about like Ethan Hawke, like he's the plain vanilla cake that these purple roses are. Denzel's purple roses are scattered across, because he's like, you know, she's kind of restrained, and he's trying to learn things. But Denzel in that movie was just like, you know, King Kong ain't got shit on me. Like, he's just like so over the top and then dialed back and then tender. Like, he's so unexpected. And that's what this Kang reminded me of a bit. Like, he's the bad guy, but he's also like enchanting. Like, he's fascinating and he's fun. He's fun to watch. even though we know what he's doing is chaotic and destructive, you know, he's zipping around, he's vanishing, he's dodging attacks, he's having the time of his life while being the bad guy. And when he's like, we're all villains here, like, I just like had to laugh and like it's so
he's like hypocrite murderer, like, you know. And I was like, it's true, because I just rewatched the pilot. I know, like, Sylvie stabs to death a bunch of TVA agents, and I'm just sort of like, Sylvie, my babe here.
But he's loving it. He is like,
yeah, no, the person that I was watching with, like, Denzel in Training Day is a great comparison, but the person that I was watching with, when they go up the elevators and you see, there's all this marble shot through with gold, and I'm going to talk about that in a second. We got an email about that. But, like, the elevators go up and they open, and the person I was watching with was like, oh, Devil's Advocate. And it's like, oh, yes. Pacino monologuing in a penthouse in New York. You know what I mean? That's another great manic villain performance that you just can't take your eyes off of. You know what I mean?
Great comparison. But both ultra bad guys. Like, both terrible. I mean, literally the devil in that case. Mm-hmm. But, like, it's the allure of the bad guy. And, you know, you mentioned, like, I think was it in your write-up, or maybe you mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, like Jonathan Majors, like, chewing through the scene. And chewing the scenery is often, like, a pejorative, like, that's a criticism of a performance. But let's be honest, like if you can chew it, then it's great. He's literally eating through most of the scene, right? Like, he's chewing on the apple. Like, he's literally chewing through the scene. And I think when it works, it's actually glorious.
Well, I mean, I think we use a similar phrase in regards to Richard E. Grant. Like, Richard E. Grant is another actor who can chew up scenery and you're just delighted for him having that meal. You know what I mean? Like, it's just perfectly calibrated. And I think that... So what I'll say is, we did get a couple emails from some folks who didn't love the finale. And here's what I think. I think if this Jonathan Majors performance isn't enchanting you the way that it enchanted us, I can see not liking this finale. Like, but I was like, I was buzzing. I was having the time of my life. And it was interesting because with the three of them in that room, and especially once they cross that threshold and they're off script, it reminded me, one of the influences that Waldron talked to me about at the beginning of the season was Inglourious Basterds, like that tavern scene, that long, tense, you don't know what's going to happen. And that's how I felt. I felt so tense. I'm like, I think our Loki, Tom Hiddleston's Loki, is not going to do anything wild. He's actually the clearest head in the room. But Sylvie's a live wire and Kang is a live wire, and I don't know what's going to happen next. I don't know. I genuinely didn't, you know, and I had a ball with that. So that's how I felt.
Well, bringing up Inglourious Basterds, like, that's another great comparison. But I would also say, you know, Denzel in Training Day, but Christoph Waltz in Inglourious Basterds, where he is in that opening scene of the movie when he goes to the little farmhouse where people are hiding, you know, beneath the...
yeah
like, he is having the time of his life. And there's something about a villain who really loves it that is, it's mesmerizing, it's hypnotic. It reminded me a little bit of something that Mark Ruffalo told me in an interview. I think it was on the set of Age of Ultron. Mm-hmm. And he said, one of the problems with Hulk as a standalone movie character is that Hulk doesn't want Bruce Banner to be there, and Bruce Banner doesn't want Hulk to be there. And it's hard to have a character that connects with audiences who doesn't want to be in the movie. You know, it's hard. It's not just a little bit of reluctance. Like, the whole point of the character, Bruce and Hulk, to suppress each other. And he's like, that's the thing they haven't cracked yet. And I think he's right. It makes the character a little bit of a drag. And so when you have a villain who's not like, oh, I'm conflicted, I have to do this. Instead, he's like, I love this. I beat out all the other Kangs. I'm Kang Prime, baby. Like, and he is...
But he's also like, I'm tired and I'm done. But also like... But what's going to happen?
But I mean, he's tired and he's done, but it's a loop, right?
Yeah,
it's a loop.
Exactly.
And that's another thing you got right, Joanna, is you said maybe this battle for supremacy is not in the past, but is actually in the future. And you were absolutely right about that. Right? Yeah. Because Kang is from, what is it?
The 31st century.
31st century. Yeah. Like, yeah. You know, but it's like another, okay, so we're putting a lot on Jonathan's shoulders here. You know, Denzel, Christoph Waltz, but I would say, but this is the one of the biggest blocks of all, is like Orson Welles in Citizen Kane, a character who starts out as a good guy and devolves into everything he says he despises, everything he stands against, and yet the more evil Kane becomes, the more like manic and energized and watchable he is. And so I feel like Jonathan really captured that with this performance, is that once you take the brakes of your own morality off of the car, you are full speed ahead. And I love this performance so much.
Me too. And listen, if you're listening and you watched and you didn't, like, that's fine. But something that is even more delightful to contemplate. Okay, so we know that we're gonna get Kang. Like, Quantumania doesn't come out till like 2023, and a lot of the repercussions of what we're seeing here are going to ripple out into various things. Like, we presume Multiverse of Madness. We have to wonder if the upcoming animated What If is just, you know, which is going to be these riffs on these Marvel characters, is just going to be actually like a tour through the Multiverse of Madness, etc. All this sort of stuff, which is to say that, like, Jonathan Majors is in it for the long haul. And not only that, but like, we're going to get to see him play different flavors of Kang, because they're going to give us all the variants. So, like, Jonathan Majors, who's such a nimble performer, who's so good and so surprising in everything that he does, is going to get to show us not just this great thing that he did, but like all the other tools in his little, like, you know, Swiss Army knife. And I gotta say, Brolin did a great job with Thanos, but like, I messaged someone while I was watching this. I was like, this is better. This is so much better than Brolin. Sorry, it is. I love this. So I'm all in. Let me zoom back to the, I promised I would talk about the marble. We see this, like, you know, this marble shot through with gold sort of vibe all through the Citadel. It's his temp pad is made of it. The little figures on the desk are made of it. It's this constant material in the place. And we got a couple emails about this, actually, but I'm going to read the most recent one that came through. Sorry, recency bias. This is from Abigail, and she says, one particular part of the set design of the Citadel in the Loki finale were the veins of gold throughout the structure, including windows. I feel certain that it's a reference to Kintsugi, also known as Kintsukuroi, I'm sorry, the Japanese art of using gold to repair a broken object, thereby making it even more beautiful. It makes me wonder if this is actually a place for hope going forward with the multiverse, that when the chaos that Sylvie unleashed is reined in again, that whatever the timelines look like going forward, it will be better than the single, inflexible, sacred timeline that has been experienced so far. So that's from Abby. I want to say something really quickly before you jump on this, which is, I learned about this from Star Wars, because the Raylos taught me, because when Kylo Ren puts his mask back together, it's not like seamless. It's got those red veins through it. Yeah. And that's when I learned about this whole idea. What do you want to say about it?
Oh, no. As you were reading that, I was like, oh, it's like Kintsugi. And I learned about it just slightly ahead of Star Wars, because it's a plot point on The Man in the High Castle, and which is also a time variant show, right? This is an alternate dimension where Japan and Germany, the Axis powers, were victorious in World War II. So what does the world look like if they won? And there's a character who is part of the Japanese government that oversees the western portion of North America, who he ends up traveling into a timeline that's different. That's the one, I believe it's the one where that we happen to be in, where America and England and the Allied powers won that war. And he has a feud with his son, and they break a special cup that has like a memento quality to it, and he repairs it with Kintsugi. And I was not familiar with that technique or that tradition. And that was just like a couple of months before the Rise of Skywalker. but I think I thought that same thing when I was watching this, is that it doesn't look like natural marbling. It looks like repair work. Mm-hmm. It looks like something that was
shattered. Beautiful. I think all the VFX work in this finale were like completely beautiful. Like the shattered glass effect of the timeline splintering, I thought looked incredible.
Mm-hmm.
But also I haven't slept. So if you guys disagree, let me know. I want to talk a little bit about Sylvie's choice here. So Harrison Forth, not to be confused with Harrison Ford, wrote into us to talk about the comparison to the film Seven. And I want to say to Harrison, I promise you, I wrote my article on VF.com this morning before I read your email. But basically, my article on VF.com covers this. Harrison's email covers this idea. And they've been talking all season about the David Fincher film Seven. Spoilers for the end of David Fincher's Seven, if you haven't seen it, came out in 1995. What's in the box, etc. But the end of that film is about the villain emotionally manipulating the hero into killing him. And knowing that, it helped flavor my read of what Kang is doing here, because he kind of seems like, kill me, don't kill me, I don't really care. But he also has that moment where he's like, Sylvie, do you think you can trust him? Can you really trust anyone? And then that's what sort of splinters the Loki alliance here, is the trust factor. And he's the one who planted that seed with her, and he's the one who exploits that. And that's what eventually causes her to kill him. But that's in Seven, at least, that's his plan the whole time, is to sort of incite Brad Pitt wrath and get him to kill him. And so, Kang claims he doesn't care. Kill him, don't kill him, it doesn't matter to him. But he's also like, I'm tired. I want to go. So what do you think of that Seven comparison there?
I think it's completely accurate in that in Seven, it's like, that's his art, I guess. You know, this is his manifesto, is that he's going to make, show humanity to be inherently corrupt by showing that even the person trying to stop him can be induced into doing his bidding. And that's what makes Seven such a disturbing film. The bad guy wins, even though he's technically defeated, he's deceased. But in this, I think it's the same thing. Now, there's a technique to Kate Herron's direction where you notice how occasionally the camera starts sideways or upside down, and then it tilts to, proper orientation, gravitational up and down orientation. And to me, that feels very, it feels very much like an hourglass, right? So you turn an hourglass upside down to start it going, and then it goes through its process, and then you have to turn it again. And to me, the death of this Kang, of he who survived. What is it? He who survived?
He who remains.
He who remains. Yeah. Oh, sorry. I'm mixing up Harry Potter here. The boy who lived. It's he who remains has to go in order for there to be the conflict that leads to he who remains ruling for so long.
Mm.
Right.
And also, we talked about this as a potential motivation for Kang earlier in the season. Maybe Ravonna is the end game in some way. You know what I mean? And maybe this is like how he gets to go meet Ravonna or something like that.
Totally. I just think this is the turning of the hourglass.
Mm-hmm.
That when she stabs him, that's the turning of the hourglass that resets it. And
as you mentioned, Kate keeps doing this like turning the camera all the way around thing.
And he literally says to them, he fast forwards like, either way, I'll end up right back here.
He says reincarnation, baby.
Eventually, yeah. Yeah, exactly. So I feel like that's what's happening, is that he's just turning the hourglass, and it's just going to play out again.
Mm-hmm. In
an infinite loop. And so he's not really dying, it's just starting over again.
Yeah. All right. So let me read a dissenting opinion. We gushed so much in Jonathan Majors' favor. This is not against Jonathan Majors, but this is from I She's Irish, and she has an accent on one of her vowels, which makes me convinced I'm going to mispronounce her name. But I'm going to go with Mare. But if it's wrong, I apologize. She writes, "While I know who Kang is, even though I don't think they named him, I think the introduction of him in the last episode is really cheating the mystery box element. I feel anyone who watches all the shows and movies but doesn't listen to podcasts or read comics will not know who he is and will not have any emotional link to him or any idea of even what kind of person being he is. I was also confused by the Ravonna exit and expected a scene showing where she had gone. I assumed into the fray with Sylvie. The show didn't end properly, and I guess the big reveal was that there's going to be a second season. At this point, I've had the same feeling about all three of the Marvel shows. I was really enjoying them until the last episode. I'd hate to think of Loki as just some long trailer backstory for the next Doctor Strange movie, but without a decent ending, it's beginning to feel that way." So I want to address a couple points here. Her initial point about it feeling like a cheat was exactly my argument as to why I didn't think King was going to show up, because it felt like it would be uninteresting, inert, dramatically. And I think, as I've said a couple times now, the performance is really what saves that sort of inert premise. But I think what also saves it is the idea, and someone tweeted this at me, so I'm sorry I'm not giving them proper credit, but this idea that, like, it's about Kang monologuing, but it's also this tension between Sylvie and Loki of, like, what are you going to do? And what's important to you? And can we stay united? It's still emotionally about them, even as it's Kang doing his, you know, smoke and mirrors show. What do you think about that idea?
Look, I think Mare is on to something. Yeah, if you're not aware that Jonathan Majors is playing Kang or has been cast and announced, if you're not following the movie news of the MCU, then yeah, I think you might go, who was that guy? You know, what was all that about? I mean, he explains it in the, I mean, so I'm trying to put myself in the mindset of somebody who has no idea that who Kang is, or that he is projected to be a part of future MCU storytelling. And I think, yeah, you just get this kind of wild, kooky guy in a strange, like, space castle, and yeah, I could see how that might leave you a little cold. But he does explain, I think, fairly cleanly, and I love the visuals aspect of having him create the little sculptures,
yeah,
the sand sculptures,
yeah,
that sort of detail the story. All that's very cool. But I can see how it leaves you a little bit cold. To play devil's advocate again, to invoke that phrase, I think Marvel is aware that part of the joy of the MCU is that it is a universe and it is a continuum, and that so many of the viewers are interested in the bigger picture and how things tie in and connect to each other. They almost crave that revelation as a means of, as part of the enjoyment of what they do and what makes them different in terms of movies. So I think,
yeah,
maybe,
but
I
would say sometimes it feels elegant and sometimes it doesn't, right?
Yeah.
I'm not mad about it here personally, because once again, I think, I don't know, I'm just like drinking the Jonathan Majors Kool-Aid, but in like WandaVision, when it was like three mid-credit sequence and this one's gonna set up the Marvels and this one's gonna set up that, or I talk about all the time with Ultron being an example where I think the calibration was really off in terms of feeding the forward narrative versus feeding the story they're trying to tell us right now, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't feel that way about this episode, but I couldn't really blame anyone who did, because it absolutely is a pitch forward in the MCU. I want to read Matt's email, which kind of addresses this whole sense of an ending thing. Matt,
yeah,
says, "Absolutely love the big twist to Loki's finale is that it was a TV show, not a 6-hour movie all along, and that the post-credits scene is literally just the announcement that season 2 exists, the way it should be for any TV series. This makes a lot of concerns people had about introducing the big bad late, about resolving stories completely, etc., seem kind of silly. The resolution to all the clues point to Kang, but they can't possibly introduce Kang on Disney Plus before the movies, being it's the Kang variant who set up the Kang the Conqueror, Animortus, and all the other Kangs, is so obvious in hindsight, I can't believe we didn't all guess it." So Matt's sort of pitch here that, like, it doesn't, I guess, I mean, I'm going to be asking Alan about this because you and I know a lot, but Alan knows more about TV than we'll ever learn. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious sort of like if this just, you know, thinking about the Lost comparison, there's a lot of Lost in this finale. I go into that in my article. You can go read about that there. Probably talk to Alan about it. But like, you know, Lost episodes, finales always ended on cliffhanger stuff. You know what I mean? Like cliffhangers are maybe in the era where shows are always concerned that they're going to get dropped. Like people don't do season finale cliffhangers as much anymore. But like that used to be such a big thing. And so I think the sense of dissatisfaction or a sense of dissatisfaction that I can really see people feeling is that underfed feeling around the TVA stuff. But it's still all pointing towards the next season, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I felt like it's not, it's a mini series. It's not a 6-hour movie, but it's also.
Yeah, but you know, Marvel sometimes says that, right? They say it all the time. Yeah, it's a 6-hour movie. And you're like, come on guys, it's TV.
Yeah. This is, I think, you know, I liked Lost a lot and certainly got a lot of enjoyment out of it. But I also feel like the network demand for, was it like 22 or 24 episodes a season? Like
totally
resulted in it being drawn out to a degree that eventually became unsatisfying for me, that like maybe I would have liked the resolution a little better if they hadn't taken so long to get there. It wasn't maybe worth the investment. I don't know. Maybe, you know, from your conversations with its creators, do they feel like they wish they had less time to tell the story? Like, maybe it had been.
I doubt it. I mean, it was just it's 6 episodes, right?
I mean, Lost. Like, do they?
Lost.
Who did Lost? Do they ever wish, like, oh, I wish we didn't have to fill that many hours of TV?
Yes,
like,
absolutely. I mean, they've said that very publicly. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
But at the same time, I think that. Alan, so I host a podcast. I don't talk about it a lot because it's not a VF podcast, but I host a podcast about Lost. I'm watching Lost every week. I talk about Lost all the time. It's a TV show sort of most on my brain at any given moment. And Alan has popped over on that podcast, and something that he's brought up, and Emily Vander, like all these like really smart TV people and know that way more than I do, is this idea of like with the loss of the 22, 24 episode season. Yeah, you get you don't have those like loser episodes where you're like, what the hell did I just watch? But you miss some like real beautiful gems of like, there's this great Lost episode called Trisha Tanaka is Dead that is just about the gang. I think I talked about this when we were talking about episode 3 being a filler episode, where it's just the Losties trying to fix a van. And like, it's a beautiful episode, but it's an episode that absolutely wouldn't exist in a 10 episode season. Absolutely not. You wouldn't have room for it. So there are things you lose. But they're definitely, concise storytelling is definitely the name of the game these days. So anyway, I think that's kind of most of what I want to talk about, because you and I are going to have a chance again to talk some more, get some more emails. Like I said, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com is where you can reach us. Is there anything else you want to make sure that we hit before we go?
Yeah, I wanted to talk about the music because the whole season was scored by Natalie Holt. A British composer, and I think I would love to talk to her about Pink Floyd, because the Loki theme reminds me so much of Adam Hart Mother, which has this gigantic, I think when it was a record, it was like, well, the A side of the record, like, was just like one sort of long suite, and it involves, heavy brass, the heavy keys, I guess you could say, almost like a triumphant march, and it was composed by the Pink Floyd crew, the band, as like a theme for an unmade Western. You know how Radiohead had that song called like exit music for a film? Like,
yeah.
This was considered like, this would be our score for a Western that will never be made. And it's like got these cosmic elements of it, these sort of mind trip elements of Pink Floyd. And the sort of march that we keep hearing in Loki feels very Adam Hart Mother to me. I don't know. I kept wanting to send you the score or send you like a YouTube link to that song and say, does this sound familiar? But we'll talk about that a little more in the final episode. that we
I think there's, you know, Loki gets betrayed by Sylvie with a kiss, betrayed with a kiss. Perfect stuff, I think. You know, that image of Loki stabbing someone in the back with a dagger, I love how it's sort of, because there was a second you see something materializing behind him and you're like, is it a dagger? And then you're like, no, it's a doorway. Okay. Oh, she grabbed the temp pad. Okay. Like, sort of thing. I thought that was really well done, but she pushes him through and then Hiddleston gets to do like sad face Loki, heartbroken Loki, you know, put his heart out there for her, was crying, giving us full like Desmond and Penny on Lost stuff. And then when he like goes into action, he decides to like run and find Mobius. This synth music kicks in, and I love the synth that Natalie Holt has used in this series. I think it's really crunchy. I don't know if crunchy is a word he used to describe synth, but that's how it feels to me.
Yeah, synth is usually very smooth, right? Like
it's but it's like that dank sort of 80s, like. Not quite Vangelis, but almost sort of like, you know, and I know Blade Runner is a big,
like Alan Parsons project kind of stuff.
Like. Just sort of like, yeah, get to work. Okay. Anyway, anything else you want to talk about before we go?
No, that's it.
All right. I think we did it. We're going to have Alan in to talk about some more stuff in just a second.
Do you think we praised Jonathan Majors enough? Like,
I don't know if he knows that we like him, but, you know, maybe we'll pass a note during study hall and let him know.
Oh, he's Citizen Kane meets Denzel Washington meets
Pacino.
You know who else? You know, one more performance we're going to throw on Jonathan Majors. Like, in the pantheon of wild, outlandish, semi-malevolent figures. Remember, was her name Agra, keeper from the Dark Crystal? Remember how she had all those orbs in her lair, like her observatory? And he reminded me a little bit of her, too, because, like, she's off on her own. She's ancient. She knows all the secrets. But it's also, like, she's kind of crazy. So when visitors come, she just seems totally deranged. I think throw a little bit of Agra on the fire for as we sing the praises of Jonathan Majors.
It's funny. I will add one more Muppet to the mix and say it's funny because I just mentioned actually this on the Lost podcast I do. This is a second allusion to the junk lady from the Labyrinth. Do you know who I'm talking about? The lady who like puts Sarah in her childhood room but it's just junk. That's what Miss Minutes was reminding me of, where she's like, we'll give you everything you want. Just stay here. You two can be together on the timeline. It's fine. Sylvie's like, it's all just a bunch of toys. Like, she's like, it's just fiction.
Yeah.
Nice. You know, I think about that lady a lot from Labyrinth. I love Labyrinth. Anyway, so now that we've, fulfilled our Muppet quota, we will bid you adieu. Brez will be back next episode to wrap everything up. We've got a couple of great interviews for that episode as well. Until then, Anthony Brezikin, where can folks find your work?
Find me writing away at vanityfair.com.
All right. We'll see you next time, and we'll be back in just a second with Alan Zeppenwall.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase every day. Then grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply.
All right, as promised, I am back from the break with the chief TV critic from Rolling Stone and the host of the Too Long Didn't Watch podcast, Alan Zeppenwall. Hello, how are you?
I'm tired but happy, Joanna. How are you?
Tired but happy. Sounds about right. Folks listening at home don't know this, but you're usually my constant companion in the wee hours of the morning to talk about Loki.
I'm at least on the East Coast. What are you still doing up when I'm up watching these, Joanna? What is happening?
I don't know, but I'm ready to sleep once we're done talking here. But I'm so excited to talk to you. Thank you for joining me. Especially thrilled because I know you know plenty about the TV show Lost. And as I already alluded to when I was talking to my pal Anthony Bresdkin earlier in the show, there's a lot of Lost in this Loki finale. How did all of that? First of all, what were your finale thoughts overall? Let's start there.
I have so many finale thoughts. But the broad overview is that this is a finale that had no business working, and yet it worked. So
right.
I think it sort of it does a lot of things that you really are not supposed to do, but they paid off these gambles.
That's how I feel. That if it were not for Jonathan Majors' performance, this episode is a mess. That's what I think.
Oh my God. Yeah. It's like, yeah. You know, if you get even a slightly less interesting actor to do those speeches, woof. Boy,
yeah,
oh boy.
Exactly. So wildly great performance of Jonathan Majors, which Brez and I definitely already gushed about. So let's talk about the Lost of it all.
Sure, sure.
What struck you and what do you think of, like, how does it strike you when you see the fingerprints of another show on a show like this?
It basically depends on A, whether it's done well, and B, whether they kind of the show paying homage to another show understands what made the original show work. Because you know as well as I do, so many series have ripped off Lost in the last 15, 16 years. Very few of them have done it well. And I think for the most part, Michael Waldron seems to get what was special about Lost, and it's not just let's throw out a lot of questions and have a lot of weird stuff happen, although both of those things are very much a part of Loki. It's more like, how do we use these mysteries and how do we use all these crazy sci-fi components to, like, better understand what makes these characters tick? And so when you get, are we referring to him as Kang or He Who Remains, the Scarlet Centurion?
On this show, we call him Kang, just for ease.
All right, fine. So when Kang is going on about sort of his own history, or when Ravonna is doing her spiel about free will versus destiny with Mobius, all of those things still are tied to what we understand about the characters we already know, and to a degree about Kang himself, although he's mainly an expository device here. So all those things and all the Jacob allusions and everything else, to me, felt like someone who got it and was sort of using it as a framework without just sort of shamelessly and foolishly copying it. What about you?
No, completely. I mean, I think, you know, especially right around when Lost wrapped up in the first couple of years before it wrapped up, those imitators like Flash Forward or I don't know, there's so many of them. Like they're like, okay, premise. And it's like, no, it's not premise. It's character. Yes. It's themes. It's you know, it's characters that you care about. It's emotional connection, you know. And when you've got Tom Hiddleston just like dripping tears on Sofia DiMartino as he's talking about the only thing I care about is you being okay. I mean, that is more Lost to me than any other direct allusion, you know, that we see. Right? That's how I feel, anyway.
I mean, the kiss too definitely felt a lot like several various passionate Lost smooches there. Like they went for it with that moment. I was very impressed.
Yeah, the score swelled. There was practically a dip and a stab in the back all at once. So
You know, she can't trust, although maybe he can be trusted. So that's an interesting sort of tension for season two. Is he has changed and she has not.
Well, something that I think was really interesting when you were first started giving me your impressions this morning in the wee small hours of the morning. you know, where you were talking about, like, if there weren't a season two or if this or this, that I would not be happy. So my question for you is, like, when you're looking at a season finale, what feels like a satisfying season finale to you? Like, what do you need from it?
All right. I feel like I need, if I know there's going to be another season of the show, I don't necessarily need narrative closure. I need some sort of, like, climactic element, though. It, you know, so in this case, to me, it is specifically that Sylvie kisses Loki, but also that Sylvie betrays Loki, and that Loki winds up back at the TVA, now robbed of the woman he loves and also the best friend he has just made. So right. sort of a bunch of things built together, mm-hmm. and some of them paid off, and some of them are now going to have to be dealt with in season two. I didn't need, like, the whole story of the TVA resolved so long as they're doing another year of the show. Like, if mm-hmm. if this was, like, the finale of Loki, and now the adventures of Kang and the TVA, you have to go watch Ant-Man and Wasp Quantumania, that's bad. So this gave me enough, yeah. I think.
Well, what's interesting, I mean, like, I don't know how many things Jonathan Majors is going to appear in. If there are, like, infinite Kangs, then he could yes. be in everything. and I wouldn't be mad about it, but like, yeah, I mean, he's gonna be in Quantumania, which is in 2023, and so how many things is he gonna be in between now and then is a question I have. It doesn't feel like we could pick up exactly with this plot at the start of season two, because there's so much happening in between. Reportedly they're not even going into production on Loki season two until January 2022, so which is not that far from here. But anyway, I have questions. So I don't know. I mean, we are all allowed to reassess how we feel about the finale once we see how the threads shoot off into the
yes.
MCU.
This is the thing I wrote about in my recap, which I believe is going live on Rolling Stone as we're talking, which is to me, I'm a comic book nerd. I love the crossovers. I love sort of the shared universe of it all. That's cool, but as I've gotten older, the thing I care about most are the individual stories. So it's great that this now ties into the multiverse, that Kang is going to be a villain elsewhere, that this sort of pays off things from previous Thor movies, etc. But what I care about most when I'm watching the TV show Loki is the TV show Loki, and I want that to be a satisfying experience in and of itself, and I feel for the most part they did that. And one of the main reasons I was very, like, convinced that Kang would not be the big bad was that it just felt like it would not fit that mantra. It would not be satisfying for the experience of this show, because you're just bringing this guy in at the last second who has not even been glimpsed before in the MCU, and certainly not on this show. But they pulled that off, and part of that is just because Jonathan Majors is amazing, but part of it is also they really leaned on the trauma that Sylvie and Loki have been through, and the bond they've mm-hmm. developed, and some of the stuff with Mobius and Ravonna. So it shouldn't have worked. They mostly made it work. And they mostly made it work within the confines of this 6-episode show, regardless of where the threads go from here.
Yeah, that's how I feel. We've gotten emails from some folks who weren't as satisfied, but also emails from plenty of folks who loved it. And once again, I think if I weren't so enamored with Jonathan Majors' performance, which is most of the episode, then, yes. like, you know, I don't think I would have liked the episode, but I am. So, you know, I had goosebumps. I loved it so much. The thing I wanted to float to you, and I talked to Brez about this a little bit, and I'm going to give the same preface here that I gave in the first part, which is this is not reported fact. This is, yeah. like, third-hand rumor that I heard. So I'm not reporting this officially.
Okay.
But something I heard was that in the pre-pandemic version of the scripts, Kang only appeared in an end of credits sequence. And then as they reworked the scripts over the pandemic, they decided, and I don't know why they did this, but I have some thoughts about what could have inspired this for them to move Kang to be the substance of the episode. One, they got a load of Jonathan Majors' performance. They're like, yes. we want more of that. number two, they decided around then that they want to do a second season. So they sort of truncated a lot of the stuff they shot for the TVA, which, like, if you pull out the TVA stuff, it's very wimpy. It's very minimal. And so, like, I could see, like, maybe they shot a bunch of other stuff with Mobius, with Ravonna, with B-15, etc., and they cut it out. I don't know. There is some stuff with Loki and Sylvie, like Loki on the throne of Asgard, that was in the trailer that isn't in the show. So I'm yeah. wondering if, like, maybe that whole, like, Miss Minutes temptation sequence is longer and they see visions of themselves, like, that she's describing and stuff like that. Like, that could all have happened. But maybe they were just trying to, like, move pieces around to create a season two cliffhanger rather than just tease Jonathan Majors for Quantumania. What do you think about
that? I think that, I mean, as sort of troubled as I was by the idea of bringing Kang in at the end, if you don't meet the big bad at all until the mid-credit stinger, that's worse to me. I mean, I don't know what the original plan was, and you know, like you say, this is third-hand rumors, so I don't know how far, like, off the reservation we want to go here, but I feel like, as weird as this was, it's definitely a better solution from what I'm now picturing in my head instead.
Yeah, I mean, I think I, you know, and this goes to, this maybe feeds into this interview that Tara Strong gave midway through the season, where she was talking about, like, how there's a lot more to come from Miss Minutes, and, like, certainly we get some sinister Miss Minutes stuff in here, but, like, maybe Miss Minutes is, like, kind of the big bad of the finale, you know what I mean? And then you get a little Kang button at the end. Like, that would be an episode. Certainly could, it's an episode I could certainly see coming from some folks who worked on Rick and Morty, but, like, this Kang stuff is so much better, I think.
Yes.
You know, because of this performance.
And, I mean, I love Tara Strong. I think she's fantastic, but that's... Yeah. Yeah. Trying to envision just them talking to the floating clock for that long is not so much.
What do you think the show? Oh no, let's go back to that that episode three, the Lamentous episode, which is mostly the Sylvie and Loki sort of spending time together episode. And there was a lot of kerfuffle around that episode about it being like there not enough happened, or it's quote unquote filler or whatever, right?
My but eyes, like, are rolling into the back of my head right now as you say that.
But, like, I mean, I don't want to, you know, grind people's nose into the dirt too much, but I have to say that, like, our suspicion when we watched an episode like that, and those of us who, like, watch too much TV, is that, like, okay, they really need to sell us on this relationship is going to need to feel earned. We're going to need to believe Tom Hiddleston when he's crying alone back at the TVA that his heart is broken. And so they need to take the time in a six-episode season, even in a six-episode season, to give us that episode where it's the two of them together. What do you think of it, like, in light of the finale? And, you know, do you think it was the most successful version of what they needed that to be?
I think it was, because I think you're right. Like, if the relationship doesn't matter, then none of this matters. Then it's just people running around and timey-wimey. And it's still fun because it's got Hiddleston and the great production design and everything Kate Herron was doing. But it's empty calories. And so I think they really needed to do that. And I remember when those complaints were happening that time, the one thing people said was, like, maybe in, like, you know, definitely in a Lost length season, but even in a 13 or 10 episode kind of season that, you know, is mostly done, they would have been cooler with it. But in only six episodes of story, they were a little troubled that an entire episode was devoted to this, and they were worried that everything else would feel rushed. And I think part of that was also we didn't know if there was going to be a second season. I think definitely some things did feel rushed in these last couple of episodes, especially the TVA material. I really have sort of little sense of what went on when Mobius and B-15 got back there, when they got to see Ravonna as... Was she a school teacher? Was she the principal? I couldn't quite make out, like, the signage there.
This is my favorite thing about talking to you in the morning, Alan Sepinwall, is you'll, like, ask me, like, really detailed questions about an episode that, like... Only you want to like study the very corners. That's why you're so good at what you do. And I'm like, oh, it wouldn't have occurred to me to look at that. I assumed I was saying teacher before, but now that I think about our office and the fact she has a diploma on the wall, I'd probably get administrator, principal, something like that.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So Principal Renslayer, or whatever her name was back then.
Yeah.
So there's all these bits of business that don't really go anywhere, and you can kind of fill in the blanks yourself. And to a degree, I would rather see what we saw than see that. But there's definitely some, like, you know, spit and wire holding things together here because they had spent so much time on Loki and Sylvie earlier. But again, I think they spent the time on the stuff that mattered, and we're going to get another season of it. And so we'll get to see some of these things pay off later. So I'm good with it. And that is, like, episode three was one of my favorites, except for all the others that have come after it. It's been a really good run.
Where do you put this with the other... you know, Disney Plus shows, Lucy. I mean, you know, like, this finale dropped at midnight on Emmy announcement Tuesday, when Disney Plus and Marvel cleaned up with a mountain of Emmy nominations for WandaVision, and, you know, a few for Falcon and Winter Soldier.
Don Cheadle, like, baby. Yeah.
Don Cheadle and not Carl Lumley, a terrible crime. Not, they're not in the same category. I'm just saying. Yes. You know, I would love to throw an Emmy at Carl Lumley for what he did in Falcon and the Winter Soldier. Like, what do you think about the state of Disney Plus Marvel TV right now?
I think this is easily my favorite of them. It's not perfect, but I liked it overall more, and I definitely thought it was the best ending of the three. Wanda, I really enjoyed, but I think parts of the sitcom stuff worked much better for me than other parts, and I don't know that, like, there were necessarily, like, a six episodes in that. And part of that is, I believe, as you've reported, the way they edited it, because originally it might have just been six episodes of the show total. But overall, that was really good. It just sort of faltered at the end. Falcon was mostly a mess, and Falcon is also, maybe coincidentally, maybe not, the one that feels closest to what they already do in the movies. And these other two feel very weird and very different, and very much like television, which, you know, as someone who covers TV and cares passionately about it, I enjoy. So, yeah. I don't know, where they were with Hawkeye or She-Hulk or any of the other stuff while these things were airing and being received, but I would like to think, at least for future projects beyond those, Kevin Feige and everybody else are looking and seeing, no, the audience wanted this and not that, and that, like, hopefully the MCU in the future on Disney Plus sort of keeps moving in this direction.
This sort of, like, feels like television is kind of weird and wonderful. I mean, like, Kang showing up and, you know, Jonathan Majors showing up and doing his thing felt like some of the, like, more fun, weird parts of WandaVision. Do you know what I mean? Like, just, I mean, all of Loki feels kind of gonzo, of course, but, like, I just think that performance, you know, you put that performance next to what, like, Catherine Hahn is doing, and you've got Yahtzee, right? Like, that's just like really fun stuff. For me, like, I still think I put WandaVision, give it a slight edge over Loki. I really loved that up until the finale, but I far prefer the Loki finale to the WandaVision finale. I think it's the most successful finale they've done. So the idea that maybe they overhauled it during the pandemic, I'm just impressed by that. Something I wanted, this is something that, you know, as you know, I do a Lost podcast. This is something we talk about a lot on Lost. The Lost accusation that they got all the time was like, oh, they were just making it up as they go along. And I'm like, yeah, that's called writing. Like, I don't know what to tell you. But, like, something that Vince Gilligan and his writers would always say on Breaking Bad is that at the end of a season, they would like to sort of write themselves into an impossible corner and sort of be like, how's old Walt going to get out of this one, sort of thing, and set, you know, and not know how they were going to do it. And so they're making it up as they go along. And I, like, ever since I heard him talk about that, I'm just sort of like, I think that accusation is bullshit to say, like, oh, no, they're just making it up as they go along. I'm like, the only time that that's a legitimate complaint is if they do a bad job of writing themselves out of the corner that they've gotten themselves.
And the counter argument that I will always make is How I Met Your Mother, because that is, like, the classic example of a show that planned things out way in advance and then refused to, like, modify that plan as the show evolved beyond it, and resulting in, like, one of the worst finales ever made. And it's a finale that basically is only liked by people who had stopped watching the show years earlier and came back for, it's like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. So, like, plans are great. Like, David Simon, when he plans out The Wire, that obviously works very well. You know, Babylon 5 has a lot of ardent fans. But I think for the most part, TVs are, like, evolving organisms, and you can do a little planning, but you can't plot out everything. You've got to be flexible. You've got to see what your actors are giving you, what your directors are doing, just sort of where the story is going, and then evolve from there. And yes, if you're as talented as Vince Gilligan, you can put a machine gun in the trunk of Walt's car with no clue whatsoever who he's using it on or why, and, like, beat your head against the desk until you figure it out. But definitely the fact that they can do that, and that's one of the most beloved shows of all time, I think it's makes stuff up. It's part of the writing idea.
Right, and so then when I hear, like, oh, we majorly overhauled some scripts in the pandemic, I'm like, good. I mean, great. I mean, that's another thing that baffled me about this whole pandemic pause, a very genteel way to describe it. But, like, if folks weren't working and reworking their TV shows and film, like, what were you doing? Like, you had all this gimme time to like work on this. Maybe I'm misunderstanding something, and that's a completely privileged way to think about it. But like, if it were me, I would be refining and refining and refining with that time.
Yeah.
As a comic book nerd as you are.
Yes.
I want to ask you like what you understand about Kang and how much you feel like this episode did a good job of premising who Kang might be in this universe.
Okay, well, one of the reasons I was asking about what we're calling him is because they do not use the name Kang in Correct. The episode. Even in the credits, John of the Majors Correct. Is listed as He Who Remains, which is what Miss Minutes calls him.
Correct.
In the comic books, this character, whose real name I believe is Nathaniel Richards, mm-hmm. is a descendant of Reed Richards' father, who was himself like a time traveler or inventor or something. He builds a time machine, travels back to ancient Egypt, becomes a pharaoh calling himself Ramatut, then travels through time again, runs into Dr. Doom, who might also be his ancestor, or maybe not, because comic book lore keeps changing all the time, decides he's now going to be a conqueror named Kang, and he doesn't. He only uses the time travel at that point just to sort of like gather men and materiel, and he then invades like time periods that are otherwise unguarded, takes them over, and chills for a little bit until he wants to conquer something else. Then at a certain point, he evolves into Immortus, who has a really cool beard and a very big wizard hat and is trying to sort of like keep control of the time stream itself. So he's really like Mr. Time Travel. The other two Kangs are only about like ruling where they are right now or getting into fights and winning these fights. Immortus like plays with time, snips alternate realities, works with the timekeepers. So he keeps evolving. There's also the Scarlet Centurion and a couple of other identities that I'm perhaps missing at this point. And the reason I bring this up is because I feel like the way that the Jonathan Majors character we are watching in this episode is describing his history and the wars he's had with all of these variants is, I think he's maybe all of those. Like, I think now all the different Kangs are in play, and we're probably not going to see him as a pharaoh, although having Jonathan Majors playing him instead of a white guy definitely makes that more palatable. But just I think, like,
yeah.
I think we're definitely, like, the idea that there's all these different alternate Kangs in the same way that we got a glimpse of so many alternate Lokis over the course of this season. Like, I would like to think that if Majors is available for all of these things, the character he plays in Quantumania is going to be very different from the character he plays right. in Loki Season 2,
right.
and very different from the character he plays in any other appearances they pay him to make over the next few years in the MCU.
I mean, yeah, I'm excited for us all to like hear from Majors and like what his thought process is behind everything. But like, you have to think that that was maybe a massive commitment. If they're asking, hey, do you want to come and sort of just be in everything, playing different versions of a character? I think that'd be really fun. It's different from Thanos, and that was a big question of like, how do you follow Thanos, right? is so massive, both literally and just sort of like as he loomed over the MCU. And so I think this idea of like the many Kangs, or whatever you want to call him, Immortus or Nathaniel or whatever, He Who Remains, played by one actor, I think that's a really exciting prospect.
And even in this episode, like every line reading could be from a different performance, like just the way, and again, this is no business working. This should be so self-indulgent and weird and annoying. And yet he pulls it off and makes it like he sells the idea that this guy has been alive forever and has encountered so many different variations of himself that he kind of has, like, by osmosis become all of them. And therefore, like, you, even in a conversation with just this one guy, you're getting a half a dozen of them.
Exactly. Exactly right. And then, like, how does, like, overall, as a comic book guy, like, how has this show done feeding, because the thing about Waldron is he's brought on for head writer of this, is that he's not really a comic book guy. He's a Rick and Morty guy. He's a wrestling guy. He's not really a comic book guy. Whereas, like, some creators that you have working at Marvel Studios are comic book people, like a James Gunn or something like that.
Yes.
But, sometimes it's better to have someone who's like sort of writing from outside the club about what's going on in the club. And so like, how do you think Waldron and his staff, we should say, did, with this assignment, with this Loki, like how much does it feel like a true comic book show? How much does it feel like something else entirely?
To me, it felt, and again, I'm coming at this from like someone who immediately recognizes Throg bouncing around in the jar and all of those little Easter eggs. So, although weirdly, I had never encountered the Thanos copter before last week, and I'm so sad for myself that this was my first encounter with it. Because
but
I
now
think
you
of
have
all
many
the joy
more.
I could have had.
but you, the joy is waiting for you in the future, Alan.
Yes, so this is true.
Future copter joy you can have.
So I will say, from my perspective as a super nerd whose like very first comic book ever was The Avengers Fighting the Absorbing Man in like the late 1970s, like this satisfied me. This felt true to Loki, to the world, to the TVA, to sort of all these different concepts they incorporated, including Kang or whatever we're referring to him this minute. That was all good. What I wondered about and what I think actually worked because he was an outsider, even if there were other people working with him who were not, was I think it works for people who don't know this stuff. I was talking to my friend Brian Grubb earlier, and he doesn't know any of the comic book stuff and is not really super into the MCU to begin with. And he had just watched the Loki finale, and I said, like, could you understand it? Did you enjoy it? He said, well, I couldn't really follow all of the Kang stuff, but I liked it. And I think, like, if they're achieving that, then it's working. You know what I mean?
I completely agree. Like, and that's the whole thing about this Kang introduction. I had so much trepidation because, like, all signs were pointing to Kang. And I was like, no way it's Kang. They're not going to do that to the poor newbies. They're not going to drop a Kang out of nowhere on them in the finale. It's not going to work.
You can't do that. That's such bad storytelling. And yet it worked.
And then it worked. So we witnessed a miracle today, Alan Sepinwall.
I guess the secret is, you know, if you hire Jonathan Majors for all these impossible parts, you know, you can do it.
You can make it work. Think of all the things. Like, what if he had been the mother? Then everything would have been fine on How I Met Your Mother. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, I don't think they would have ever killed off the mother.
If it had been Jonathan Majors. No, keep him. Let me ask you a forward-looking question. What are you excited about that's coming in the MCU?
Well, I'm really excited to see Hawkeye just because the Matt Fraction run on those two characters is one of my favorite comic books in a very long time. And if they're using that as the template, which they seem to be, that should be exciting. And Jeremy Renner is a guy who I've always sort of found better when he's allowed to be funny in a way that this storyline and this milieu should let him be. Like, Haley Steinfeld's really good casting, so I'm looking forward to that. I love She-Hulk. I love She-Hulk, like, in the courtroom in the Dan Slott comic that they seem to be, you know, referring to as the influence for that. So that's exciting, too. And Maslany, you know, can do anything. Like, she could have played Kang, and that would have been good as well. But so the definitely, like, one of the things they're doing right now that I'm impressed by is they're not necessarily just bringing in big stars. Mm-hmm. And obviously, Owen Wilson is a big star. But a lot of the other people are a bit less known than that in this phase that are coming in. But they're really versatile. They can sort of sell ridiculous things. I mean, look at all the stuff that Jonathan Majors had to do on Lovecraft Country to make feel real on a show that was all over the map in terms of tone and genre and everything else. You know, and look at all the things Maslany had to do on Orphan Black. So I like that they're bringing in these kinds of people and giving them big, meaty roles and not just saying, we're the MCU, let's get the most famous people we possibly can at this point. Because we've lost RDJ, we've lost Chris Evans, you know, we're losing other people.
Well, and like, the ethos at the beginning of Marvel Studios, right, is like, RDJ was sort of, you know, down on his luck when they cast him as Tony Stark. They made Chris Evans. They made Chris Hemsworth, right? Like, that was sort of where they started. And so, like, we're seeing this already with, like, Black Widow. Not that Florence Pugh wasn't known. She was Oscar nominated. But, like, they're putting Florence Pugh and with brilliant casting and a brilliant performance into a place where she can vault into a sort of Chris Evans level spot if she wants to from here. Do you know?
Yeah, I mean, she already feels by the end of that movie like, I really like ScarJo. She was very rarely given enough to do in these movies, but Florence Pugh already feels like if they just slot her in to the things that Natasha did, she can already fit seamlessly into that, and hopefully she gets more to do ultimately.
Right, and so then when you put in a Jonathan Majors, like, I'm not worried about, oh, what are they going to do after Thanos? Oh, they're going to do Kang, and it's going to be amazing. That's what they're going to do. It's so funny that you brought up Tatiana Maslany in Orphan Black, because I just realized, essentially, they're hiring Jonathan Majors to do Orphan Black. Yes. If they're asking him to do all these variants, that's wild. It's gonna be really fun.
I remember years ago when I was doing a junket for Star Trek Nemesis of all things, and I'm the only time I had ever interviewed Sir Patrick Stewart, and we're talking, and I asked specifically like about the fact that he and Ian McKellen are like both involved in multiple, you know, sci-fi slash fantasy franchises. Mm-hmm. And what is it like that why are they in such high demand for those? And he said, like, basically it's because they're classically trained and therefore they're able to sort of take these crazy things and give some level of believability to them, even as like the warp drive is going and the dragons are flying and the Balrog is smashing through and everything else that's happening. And like Maslany or Major may not necessarily be known for like Shakespeare, but they do have that same kind of skill of like, I'm going to take this ridiculous thing and I'm going to make this guy seem like a person, even though his personality changes every 5 seconds.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's a great point. I love that. What about the What If series that's coming out, this animated? I know that it's a comic book premise, but like now that we've seen the end of Loki, do you feel like What If is just going to be instead of just sort of a flight of fancy, is it going to be an actual representation of what a multiverse gone mad looks like?
It certainly could be that, and I'm excited. Like, I really want to see the Captain Carter episode, among others. I really want to hear, you know, Chadwick Boseman play T'Challa one more time. Yeah. That trailer looked great to me. I'm fine if it is just an anthology show like the comic book originally was, but there were certain points in which What If was used to fuel other things. I'm pretty sure that Spider-Girl, the Peter Parker's daughter from an alternate timeline, first appeared in a What If, and people loved her so much that they just turned that into an ongoing series. They did a few other storylines where What If characters or concepts burst out into the main MCU. So if they want to do that, they can. And if they just want to use it to illustrate the multiverse, like you said, they can do that too. But I also think that there is nothing wrong, especially in this day and age, with just having a really well-made anthology show where each, like, you watch any particular episode and you get something really satisfying there.
Yeah. I mean, I think the two highlights you mentioned are the highlights for me. But, like, I think it's interesting that What If has existed in the comics as a proving ground for a concept. Because, I mean, if they wanted to give me a Captain Britain, Hayley Atwell show, I would watch it so quickly. I mean, I know people not enough people watch Peggy Carter, so maybe Marvel doesn't believe me when I say that, but you gotta believe me.
I'm just trying to think, like, so they're gonna have to CGI like these huge physiques onto both Maslany and Atwell. Well, I guess if they can make She-Hulk work, they can definitely make a live action Captain Carter show work.
I mean, listen, like, you know, they've got the mocap down for Mark Ruffalo where you're getting smart Hulk Ruffalo face with the Hulk body, so, you know.
Yes, all right, I'm there. I'm down with it.
What about, have you spent any time thinking about, like, how this could feed into the Doctor Strange film that's coming up?
Well, it's just, there's times in which I wish I didn't know as much as I did. Because, like, then, like, I didn't know that it was called Doctor Strange of the Multiverse of Madness, and Wanda's going to be in it, and that after that, you're going to get a Spider-Man movie featuring, like, all of these characters from the Sam Raimi and Mark Webb films. Like, I mean, I do kind of, in a way, miss the days when we could be surprised by that stuff. But at the same time, like, the fact that they're now opening up the multiverse and bringing in lots of alternate things feels to me like there are so many possibilities, and it could be a situation where what we think we know is only a fraction of what's going to be there. And I'm definitely glad to see Raimi, like, doing a superhero movie again with Doctor Strange. And it's weird to have him then setting up a Spider-Man movie that he's not making, but I'm looking forward to both of those too.
I want to ask you about a bigger picture TV question, which is, obviously this is like a new era of Marvel, not just because the platform Disney Plus, but because like Feige et al. At Marvel Studios are masterminding this versus the Jeff Loeb era of the shows at Netflix, which were hit and miss. You know, like, I'm a big Daredevil season one fan, but, you know, some of those seasons not so great, a lot of them suffering from that like middle section Netflix flab and like all the stuff like that, right? But like, you know, what do you see Feige et al. Doing better, not just because they have the ability to weave it into their movie franchise, what are they doing better that these other shows, maybe Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., maybe Netflix, if you feel that way, weren't doing.
I mean, I think that being able to weave is kind of a double-edged sword, honestly, because I think some of the things that went awry with both the WandaVision finale and the Falcon and the Winter Soldier finale came directly out of the fact that these stuff is tied to the movies. They now need to send Wanda off to interact with Stephen Strange in another movie. They need U.S. Agent to be part of something, whether it's Secret Invasion or an upcoming movie. They kind of need to set up this stuff. And because of that, the stories couldn't necessarily go where the previous episodes of those seasons seemed to be taking those characters. So I think that there's a degree to which, like, the shows still feel kind of subservient to the movies in the way that Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. was at the beginning. The difference is now, like, they're allowed to feature bigger and more prominent characters, whereas, like, the best Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. could get was, like, Lady Sif.
Right.
And I like Lady Sif, don't get me wrong. I'm just saying, like, it was very much a one-way street, the communication between that show and the films. So I think that's better. I think what makes these shows better is really not the fact that they have access to these characters. Although these are great characters and they're played by great actors, and in many cases, better actors than some of the people who were cast in the Netflix shows. But I think it's more just like they're better told. I think they're hiring better creatives. I think they have a better sense of like what a TV show is and how it's supposed to work. The fact that Disney Plus wants to do weekly releases, I think, is certainly helping fuel that. I think if Netflix was doing weekly, maybe Jessica Jones and Daredevil, would have been making different choices than they did. We'll never know. But I saw somebody associated with one of those shows ironically saying that they felt that Loki and the Disney Plus shows felt like movies broken into bits, when to me it's the exact opposite of that. Like, these feel, for the most part, other than Falcon, like a television show, and it's been, for the most part, much better as a result, because there's just things that work on television that don't work in movies and vice versa, and you need people who can understand the difference, and you need like them to be creative on top of that.
I'm trying to think. So, like, when I talked to Waldron before the season started, he was saying that he really did want to make those episodes feel like, those six episodes feel like distinct episodes. So I'm going to do a thought experiment right now and see if I can do the one where with all those episodes, right? So the first one is, like, the one where Loki goes to the TVA, right?
Yes.
It's the first. Okay.
It's the premiere. So, premieres are often, like, not distinctive other than, here's the premise of this season. Yes.
Right. What would you do for episode two?
Episode two is the one where they're buddy cops, although even that's only like half the episode. So
the one where they go to Roxcart. I mean, I feel like I keep coming up with locations. That's kind of cheating. But the buddy cop one, the one with Pompeii. I don't know. Whatever.
Yeah.
Episode three, the Sylvie episode, the one with Sylvie, right?
Yes, exactly. The one where they're on a moon that's about to blow up. The Doctor Who episode, whatever you want to call it.
The Doctor Who episode is good, or the Before Sunrise episode, right?
Yes, all of these things work. That is definitely easily the most standalone of all of them, even though it feeds into stuff that happened before and after.
I agree. And then I think one of the toughest ones is episode four. Because that's the one where Sylvie and Loki temporarily go back to the TVA, but I don't, like, I was looking up the premise of that episode, the synopsis of that episode, and I was sort of like, huh. I mean, I liked that episode fine, but not a ton happened, right? It's sort of
well,
a lot
I mean,
of
they do like cut off the heads of the timekeepers.
Oh, but you're right. Okay, sure. The one where they cut off the heads again. The one where B-15 wakes up. The one.
But
I think it's
sort of like the premiere in the fact that even like as long as your show is semi-serialized, there are going to be some episodes that are completely distinctive, and there are going to be some episodes that are just, we got to move the plot along. And you know this even better than I do, revisiting Lost for the Storm, which is like, there are a lot of really distinct Lost episodes, but some of them are just, we got to move the chess pieces around, and we'll sort of try to use a flashback to make it seem distinctive, but it's really just an excuse to, we got to get this guy here, we got to get this guy here. And that's okay. And as long as you don't do too many of them. The problem is a lot of modern streaming shows, especially, that's all they do.
Mm. The one with all the Lokis.
Yes. Love it. Love it. Love it.
With all the Lokis. And then the one with Kang.
Yes. It's so funny, by the way, like, everyone was convinced that Richard E. Grant was going to be in three episodes of the show. And I don't know if it was just because that's what IMDb listed or if it was reported elsewhere, but he's in one episode plus 5 seconds of another one.
I mean, I definitely thought he was like the big bad behind everything, but that's just because I wanted to see Richard E. Grant. I mean, like, Jonathan Majors is incredible, but I also think Richard E. Grant could probably captivate me monologuing for an episode too. So, you know, it's, he's just that kind of guy. But yeah, I mean, I think the show pretty much passes that, the one wear test pretty much.
Yes.
I could not ever even dream of doing it with Falcon the Winter Soldier. Not for a second. Then it's easy to do with Wanda because of the the TV eras.
Yes, even the episodes that are not TV shows are very distinctive. Here's the one about Jimmy and Darcy. Here's the one where we find out what happened to Wanda in between the movies. You know, here's the finale.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so good job, Michael Waldron. You made some television.
I got two questions for you.
If you
don't mind me hijacking your own podcast.
Sure. Please hit me,
Okay, the first one is, what was Sylvie's original plan? What was she trying to do?
Kill the people responsible for causing her pain.
Okay, and so the various time bombs that she's been stealing.
Oh, I mean, that I hate, because they bomb the time. I mean, I like the show a lot, but they bomb the time. She bombs the timeline as a distraction, right? And I get that, that's her plan. She's going to distract everyone. She's going to go up the elevator. She's going to lop off the heads of the timekeepers as revenge for what they did to her. But then it's an emergency at the end of one episode, and then it's never mentioned again.
Yes.
And like, that drove me insane.
I saw a lot of coverage convinced that that was, in fact, the birth of the multiverse, because, again, we know what the next few movies are about, and so we assume it's coming. And I guess not. She just set off some fireworks? I don't. It's confusing.
Yeah, it just feels like a distraction, but I just really didn't like that it was a big emergency that ended one episode and then was never mentioned again. I needed someone to be like, well, glad we resolved that pretty quickly by blooping the blorp. You know what I mean? Like something. But they didn't even bloop the blorp. So I don't know. Felt messy. All right, okay. What else? What's your
second question?
Yeah.
Did you need to see a jet ski by the end of this season?
I mean, once again, I feel like this is part of what was pruned out to make room for all the Kang, is my suspicion. Did I need to see a jet ski? No. What I was hoping to do was to find out Mobius's backstory, you know, and that has just been completely shunted to season two. We don't know anything. You know, we know B-15, or at least B-15 knows her backstory, but Mobius hasn't even been, like, to use some Losty parlance, like, he hasn't even been woken up yet. You know what I mean? Like, so what's going on? So that felt a little frustrating. Also, like, talking to the lovely Kate Herron, who I think did a phenomenal job directing these episodes, but she was, you know, one of the things she was asking is, like, you want to know why Sylvie's hair is blonde and why she goes by Sylvie? And I'm like, yeah, I don't think I got answers to any of that. Like, why did she dye her hair blonde? Why does she abhor the name Loki? Is it because it's associated with the persecution? Is because she had to hide her identity to hide from the TVA this whole time? I can extrapolate that, but no one's ever said that, you know?
So. I'm trying to remember, is she blonde in the flashback when she's a little kid?
No, she's got brown hair. Yeah.
Okay, all right. So, yeah.
So those are highlights, and those are professional. That's no Black Widow in her bathroom bleach. Those are some profesh highlights that she got done. So,
well, I mean, there's got to be some apocalypse she hid out in where there was a salon.
I suppose so. But yeah, I mean, I do think that there are questions that were planted that maybe they planned to answer, and then Marvel liked the show so much they decided to do a second season. So they're like, well, you know, Apple S, control save that, and explore it in season two, I suppose. You know,
I just like that they're at least allowing the possibility of these shows to continue, because WandaVision's not going to. Sam is going to be in a Captain America movie before there's even the possibility of them doing another season of that show, assuming they ever do. So I don't want them all to just be miniseries. That's the great thing about comics and these characters, is you can tell so many stories with them, and especially for some of these more minor characters, at a length that there's just not room to do anything with them in the movies.
Well, I think what's interesting about Marvel Studios is, despite the fact, and this is something that folks who work there said to me, and I don't think they're just blowing smoke, but, like, despite the fact that they have so many plates spinning right now, way more than they used to when they were just making a couple movies a year, And even a couple of movies a year felt like a pretty steady clop. But like right now, they've got so many balls up in the air, but they're still a very pliable. They're very pliable storytellers. And so I feel like when they, you know, when they have to juggle shows and WandaVision has to come out before Falcon the Winter Soldier because it's done first, like that's fine. Or when, you know, Julie Louis-Dreyfus has to show up in Falcon the Winter Soldier before she premieres elsewhere. If people haven't watched the latest things, then I'm not going to say, like, you know.
Whatever could you be referring to, Joanna?
Yeah, that was really slick. You know, like, it doesn't really matter, right? It doesn't matter.
Yes.
And you know, if they're watching a Loki show, they're watching the dailies or whatever, and Kevin Feige or whoever at Marvel Studios is like, we should definitely do more of this, you know? Then they rewrite their finale, bring in Jonathan Majors, and set up a season two. You know what I mean? So I think like comics,
yeah.
You know, they're gonna green light these mini runs, and then like if it's a popular storyline, like Fraction's Hawkeye, it's just gonna keep going until Fraction doesn't want to write it anymore. So you know, it's gonna be audience dependent. It's gonna be whether they like it dependent. So. But I like that it's pliable like that. I like that Falcon the Winter Soldier can launch to a movie and WandaVision can launch to a movie, but Loki can just launch to itself in season two. Like,
yes.
That's interesting.
Yes.
All right. Anything else you want to say about this episode?
Well, I mean, I have a lot of things to say, Joanna, but I just want to let you get some rest. I, you know.
Thank you. You and Anthony are so concerned for me. I so appreciate it.
I've been trying to keep my energy high just so, like, you don't nod off in the middle of it, because I'm a loud and voluble person by nature, but.
Yeah, we'll have another. We're doing a wrap up episode. So folks, you know, if there are things that we didn't cover that you're irate that we didn't talk about, you can always email me stillwatchingpod@gmail.com and Bresnikan and I will cover it in our final wrap up episode. Alan, I of course hope that I get to have you on this and many podcasts again in the future. But until then, where can folks find you and your work?
All right, so I'm on most social media at Seppenwall, except Facebook. I'm at Alan Seppenwall, and I'm at Rolling Stone. I appear regularly. My Loki recap did, in fact, go up while we were recording this. If you want to go read it, it's at rollingstone.com now. I've got the podcast, which you mentioned earlier, Too Long Didn't Watch, the premise of which is in every episode, a celebrity guest, I sit down with them, we pick a show they've never seen before, and we watch only the first episode and the last episode and nothing in between, and they have to try to make sense of what happened while they weren't watching. And there's 10 episodes available now, and then a second season is coming, hopefully sometime in the next month or two, and we're going to announce that shortly. But in the meantime, it's really a lot of fun, and you can hear Alison Brie have to sit through the Game of Thrones finale, which, Joanna, is not really a good episode of TV. I think you would agree with that.
I'm on board with you and Alison Brie as not thinking that's a good episode of television. I always pretend that Thrones ended with Night of the Seven Kingdoms. That's where I left my favorite characters, sitting by the fire.
Oh, I love that one.
Well, thank you, Alan. And folks, stay tuned because up next is the illustrious, the incredible Richard E. Grant. So, tough act to follow, Alan Seppenwall, but Richard E. Grant will do his best.
I want to talk with Richard E. Grant. Man, you get all the fun stuff, Joanna.
Next time, Alan. All right. Bye.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
I want to start by asking you, I actually want to start at the end and ask you about this last scene for your character in this episode. I was reading from one of the show's writer that it was just you with like a fan on your face acting at blue curtains, take after take. And I was just wondering what it was like for you to sort of dig in a VFX intense moment like that and deliver what you delivered.
Well, that's very generous of him to have said that, but it is, I mean, they were industrial sized, they were like air aeroplane wind turbines blowing at you, and then instructions coming through an earpiece of saying, you know, follow this, and this is where Asgard is now moving, so you have an eye line to follow, and basically scream your lungs out, glorious purpose, and laughing in the face of your own death. So all of that was, you know, it was my last day on it, and so you go for it. It's you're in a situation where it's everything that you're hired or trained to do as an actor, of trying to imagine something and then react to it. Except in this case, you have the advantage of actual wind coming at you, you know, just having to scream at the top of your lungs. So I hugely enjoyed it. I pretended that I had muscles in order to fight Asgard, because the costume designer resolutely refused to give me a muscle suit, which I had hoped I would have, as in the Jack Kirby drawing.
Sure. You were lobbying for muscles and you got baggy tights instead. Isn't that always the way? I want to ask you about that costume. Did you have a favorite part of the costume and a least favorite part of the costume?
All of it was my least favorite part, because I didn't have muscles. Because in the costume design drawing, I had muscles. So I thought, right, I'm flying to Atlanta. I'm just going to have to step into a muscle suit. I don't care how hot it is, because I was born without any. I would finally look like sort of Schwarzenegger in a cape. I didn't mind the horns or the, you know, how tight the head thing fitted. I didn't mind any of that. But when I said, how can I possibly fight Asgard if I haven't got the full Stallones on me? And they said, no, don't worry about that. So I had to sort of reconcile in my head that it was withered Loki taking on the universe.
I want to ask you about that cape, because you do tremendous work with the cape. There's some flourishes, there's some sort of comedic cape tossing. Do you wish more of your costumes had capes attached to them?
I had a cape in Star Wars, but that scene with the cape got cut. I'm currently just finishing up on a Netflix version of Jane Austen's Persuasion with Dakota Fanning and Cosmo Jarvis, and I do have a cape in that. So I think that it's certainly part and parcel of an English actor's life that you get to do some cape work as the decades go by, because anybody who's in period costume at all, you get to wear a cape. So I was well prepared from having played Scarlet Pimpernel on TV 22 years ago. So when I was given the cape in Loki Land, I had an experience of some fabric swishing before, put it like that.
Who are you playing in Persuasion? Are you playing Mr. Elliot? Who are you playing?
Lord Elliot, who is described as the vainest man in literature.
Yeah, excellent.
He focuses himself all over the walls. So that is Sir Walter Elliot. That's who I'm playing. Sir Walter Elliot, the old guy.
Perfect. That's going to be so fun. You know, because you are so willing to commit to capes, to whatever it takes, did you have any hesitation at all in taking this part when they offered it to you, or you immediately all in, yes, I want to do this?
All in, yes, because, yeah. You know, it's something that I'd never been asked to do before. And I had long talked on and off socially with Tom Hiddleston about working together, because we don't have a dissimilar body silhouette, except he has muscles, of course. And we have this V-shaped hairline, but of course you don't see our hairlines at all once I've got that the horns headpiece on. But so when I was offered this, I thought, oh, I've been cast because to be an older version of Tom. So that didn't surprise me from that point of view. But I had no idea that I would land in Loki Land. That was a real bonus.
Did you make up a story for yourself about how long your character had been there, or were you given that backstory?
It's very simple, in that when old Loki describes how his life has been, he says, you know, I'm the god of the outcasts, and I have been living in isolation for all this time, and that it was his longing to see his brother that brought him out of isolation, and therefore then got arrested by the TVA. So that, to me, summed up, I thought, was somebody who lives eternally and in isolation like that, his baseline of his life is loneliness. And that was the key into me for what I thought I had to try and bring to that episode. That's his vulnerability.
Yeah, it's interesting though. Like I would think someone who had been that lonely, and especially a Loki who had been that lonely for so long, might be more bitter, but you're not playing him as embittered. Was there ever an instinct to play him that way?
No, because I think that's certainly my experience of loneliness and the people that I know that are profoundly lonely, is that they have great vulnerability, and that ameliorates any bitterness that they might have. I mean, it's certainly a flavor in there, but it's not something that I think if he was just bitter lemon in and out, he wouldn't bother to come back from isolation. He'd just stay being an old sort of grouch.
You mentioned sort of reckoning that they wanted you to play a version of Tom. Right. Something that we've heard a lot from folks who worked on the projects of these things that Tom gave called Loki lectures, right?
Yeah.
Which were when he sort of broke down what it meant for him to play Loki. Did you attend these Loki lectures? What can you tell us about them?
No, but I'd heard that they had had them. And Owen Wilson told me, he said, if you don't know already, Tom can, you know, chapter and verse, he can give you every single thing, the lowdown on Loki. And indeed, when I started working, before the first day of rehearsals, Tom came and saw me, and he said he is essentially self-confessed Lokipedia, walking Wikipedia or Loki and Norse. And so he gave me an outline of everything and then said, you know, just fire away and ask any questions. So it was very reassuring from my point of view, because if you were parachuted into a series that has been already established, they've shot four episodes prior to, you know, my arrival, Tom had been playing the part for over a decade, so it meant that rather than thinking, oh god, you know, how the hell do I fit in here, when in doubt ask Tom, and he always had the answer, and he was so articulate and entertaining and impassioned about it. I mean, what's so extraordinary is that he seems as gung-ho about playing this part now as I imagine he must have been on the first day that he ever did it, all those years ago. So right. He is completely invested in it, 2,000%.
Do you remember if you had any specific questions for him about any need to consult the Lokipedia?
Yeah, because it's, you know, at what level to pitch it. And he said to me when I said, you're in modern dress and I am now appearing in the classic Loki from the you know, 1960s Jack Kirby illustrations in the 60s comics, minus the muscles. You know, how will that sit with what you're doing? And he said, don't worry about that. He said, what you will bring to it and, you know, what the script gives you is the guide for that. So, and that proved to be true.
Something that one of these series writers, Eric Martin, said on Twitter was that you would just hang around the set between your scenes and just hang out, be ready, maybe take a nap on the ground if you wanted to, no muss, no fuss. Yeah. Is this your normal approach to filming or? Yeah.
I don't ever leave. I'm not a method actor, but I don't, unless they say you have to go away because we need a stand-in because there's lighting equipment that could fall on your head or endanger your life or whatever. Right. To me, the whole joy of my job is not to escape to your trailer, your Winnebago, and do that. It's to be in the place where the stuff is happening. And just being around it on the set all the time, I think that it makes for a much more concentrated way of working and keeps you in the zone, if you like, of doing it. Whereas as soon as you go out and then you're sitting on, you know, looking at your phone or iPad or reading a book or whatever, it somehow takes you out of what you're doing. So I've just found it much more pleasurable to work that way. And I've always done that. If a crew sees an actor who is there and ready when they're doing their work in order for you to be able to do your work, if you can call what I do work, then there is no gap between, okay, now we have to go and get the actors ready and get them out of their Winnebagos and, you know, get them from the real world back into the play world, you're there and ready to go. And I think that's it makes for a more efficient way of making things. But that's individual to me.
One of the you mentioned sort of channeling whatever you needed to in order to act against this fictional Asgard that you were constructing. You also get to interact a lot with this gator Loki that they have. You in fact grasp him by the tail at one point. I've seen the photos of the blue plushie they had on set, but I'm just wondering if what your gator Loki impressions were. What was it like working with that thing?
Well, it looked like the equivalent of three stuffed cushions sewn together in various sizes to approximate the shape of a soft toy alligator. So at least we had that. It wasn't just, look at this dot or look at that tennis ball stuck on a stick. So at least we had that. But, it felt very much like being a five-year-old when you're walking around and going, have a look at this. This is the magic book that's going to, if you open this book, something's going to happen and pop out. You invest something, with your imagination, because it's the soft toy was about as remote from an alligator as you could possibly get.
and my last question, another co-star of yours in this episode is, of course, Owen Wilson. And you posted this adorable photo of you guys from behind the scenes. But I was just wondering what it was like for you to work with Owen.
He is as quintessentially Owen Wilson-ish in real life as everything that I anticipated that he might be from his screen persona. He is as laid back and casual and drop dead dry humor. And he also, like me, as you can probably tell, Joanna, I like to gab, and he likes to talk and, chew the wind up as much as anybody. So he's an old gas bag like I am. So I just absolutely loved being around in his company.
Thank you so much for gas bagging my direction these last few minutes. It was a pure joy. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Joanna, in Oakland.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye. All right, bye.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love. Books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Oh. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. The jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.